Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. Let's face it, the future is now. We're living in a connected cyber society, and we need to stop ignoring it or pretending that it's not affecting us. Join us as we explore how humanity arrived at this current state of digital reality and what it means to live amongst so much technology and data. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impact of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com.
And here we are. Welcome to Redefining Society podcast with me, Marco Ciappelli, on ITSPmagazine.com. And, you know, in this show of mine, I'm on other shows as well, but this is really my baby, where I really talk about stuff that I know about, although I never know enough, and I care about quite a bit. Often is the intersection of technology and society, and what does it mean, all this technology in our life, everyday life, and for humanity. So we get philosophical quite a bit. And today I have a feeling we're gonna get philosophical, I assume, because we're gonna talk about a book that is about liberal arts. And I don't know, a lot of people nowadays, when they hear that, they kind of cringe or they get excited. I don't really know why. Maybe our guest can explain that. But I feel like it doesn't have the meaning it used to have before. And there is an entire book about this and about the fact that liberal arts are critical for our thinking and critical thinking and are being good citizen of some country where we live, hopefully a democracy. So enough with me chatting. This is about this book, and that we are talking with the author, which is Jeff Schuer. I hope I didn't chop the last name, and I did a good job. He will let us know. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Marco. It's great to be with you.
Very excited. So I hope I did a decent job in introducing what the topic is going to be,
but
I'm going to let you introduce yourself. So
thank you. Thank you, Marco. The book is called Inside the Liberal Arts, Critical Thinking and Citizenship. So it tries to square the circle of those things, critical thinking, liberal arts, citizenship. That's an ambitious project, which I try to accomplish in under 200 pages. So the readers will decide if I accomplish it. It started with the idea that people talk about the liberal arts being conducive to critical thinking, but they never showed the goods. They never explained how that works. They never defined the terms liberal arts and critical thinking. So I took a few years to figure that out, and more than a few, actually. But I defined the terms. I explained how they interconnect. I explained how imprecise some of the connections are and how solid they are on other levels. It was a big job, and I'm pleased with how it came out, and I hope readers will be too. It's taking on the entire liberal arts universe and also providing a kind of a template for students or junior scholars, graduate students, people who want to recapture their liberal arts educations, anyone who considers themselves, say, a lifelong learner, anyone in any of those categories. It's for them. It's for anyone who's interested in thinking in general. And there are many such people, believe it or not, even in our very anti-intellectual American society.
Jeff, every time I finish a podcast, I like to say, if this made you think, I did a decent job. So I don't want to give answers to people. I just want to help people to give perspectives, different angles, and then think on their own.
And they have to want to think.
They need to, you can't force not them to think. So as they say, you can bring the horse to the pound, but you can't force it.
Right.
To think. Mm-hmm. Right. Let me ask you this, just so that I'm assuming everybody knows what liberal arts are, but at the same time, they have become the word liberal, such a political concept that I think it's kind of not clear anymore. So how would you define what is liberal art?
I would begin by saying it's an unfortunate term for something that doesn't have another convenient term for it. We could call it critical inquiry, but the term liberal arts has stubbornly persisted over the centuries and even the millennia. It started in your home country in ancient classical Rome, where the term artis liberalis in Latin meant the skills, not the arts, but the skills of a free citizen of the Roman Republic. It didn't really mean anything connected with arts as we know it, or with liberal as we know it in the ideological sense of liberal. It meant skills for citizenship. And the miracle is it still means that. It still means that. Although the idea of the liberal arts has gone through a long historical trajectory. It has expanded in many places. And I would also suggest it really starts, not to take anything away from classical Rome, it really starts in ancient Greece with the first attempts at philosophy and at rationality by Plato, Aristotle, and others. They devised the most basic questions: what is nature, what is value, what is thinking, what is philosophy, what are ideas, what is the mind, all of that. What is causality, for example. They put these ideas on the table, and they've evolved since then. Many of them are still on the table. Some of them are very contestable still. But over the course of history, the liberal arts started with the trivium and the quadrivium, the grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and then it included music, astronomy, and so on. And now, because it's the nature of philosophy to ask general questions, and it has spawned other questions that have created their own disciplines, whether it's economics or sociology or psychology or linguistics or many, many other liberal arts fields. Not every field, but many of them come straight out of philosophy, because philosophy asks questions that it could not answer without specific lines of empirical research. So we still have the liberal arts today, and it's still ultimately about citizenship. I would argue only about citizenship, but only once you've defined what you mean by that.
Well, how about we do that?
Okay.
What is a good citizen, or what makes a non-good citizen?
Okay. Committing a crime is not a good way to be a citizen. Let's start with that.
That I could have guessed, yes.
Yeah, but there are many ways and different levels and on which one can be a good citizen. I divide citizen into three main categories. There's a civic category, which is how we function as when we vote, when we serve on juries, when we do anything to change or keep the same the society we live in. All citizenship is transactions between the individual and the community, in which there's a two-way transaction. You give something, you get something back. You obey the laws, you get the benefits of the laws, and so on, of other people obeying the laws.
And also so, known as the social contract.
Yes, the social contract. So there's the civic side of it, which is the one that's most obvious to people. There's also an economic side. Everything we do as producers, as consumers, that affects ourselves and others, our own livelihood, and the prosperity of society. I call that economic citizenship. And then finally, there's cultural citizenship, which is all of the various conversations we have about our culture, about meaning and value in our culture, and what we like and what we stand for and whom we affiliate with, and all of that, that creates conversations. And that most of that, or much of that, is in the arts. But I would argue that sports is a locus for that too. Religion is a locus for that too. All kinds of things that we voluntarily do, our hobbies, anything that takes us outside of the home, that involves interactions with other people, is a kind of cultural citizenship.
Well, it all makes sense to me, especially when you live in a democracy where you do need to be active, because if you're not, if you don't use that civic right that you have, then you may end up losing it. Now, I'm not going to go political on this, but if we look back, as you mentioned, to, you know, even the meaning and the reason why philosophers were very involved in the political life of the antique democracies in Greece and so forth. So I guess that when you decide to write a book like this, is because you see the need for it, right?
Yes.
So what's your position then on, I'm assuming that you see the lack of this
thinking. Well, we can always need more critical thinking. There's been a lot of there's been a lot of work on it. We didn't need another book necessarily on critical thinking per se. There are many of them, good ones. And similarly, there are a lot of very good books on the liberal arts, a lot of good books on citizenship, but none that sort of synoptically put them together and create a single horizon for the whole. And that's what I was trying to do, answering the question, how do liberal arts promote critical thinking, and how do they together promote citizenship? So I saw the need for it. I also was ready for something new after writing two books on media and politics. And at the time I started this, goes back almost 10 years, but the media landscape was becoming very confusing, and I was too old to understand it. So I decided I would sort of return to my roots, which are in philosophy. I'm always interested in media as well, but my academic roots are in philosophy, and this question just grabbed me and became a consuming interest for many years.
Yeah, it's a complicated conversation. I can kind of think about that. When social media happened, it was a big change. The internet definitely was a big change. And I remember my days studying political science and information. We talked about before the internet became commercial, you know, you need to read 3 newspaper every day, at least one from the left, one from the middle, one from the right, and make up your own mind, which is very much critical thinking, I believe. And now we're just bombarded by who knows, there's no filters, and that may be a conversation for another time. But maybe, of course, they are connected. I mean, I can totally see the connection between those books. But the role of education in these, is the school system that didn't keep up with these changes? What went wrong, maybe?
That's almost too big a question for me to answer, Marco.
Take one piece of it.
One piece of it. I think the ultimate aims of education and the aims of media haven't changed. It's to inform and enlighten people and to give them context and understanding so they can function as citizens. And in fact, I think the connections between media and education are much stronger than most people realize. Media is adult education, really. Education is preparing people to be adult consumers, adult citizens, and so on. So they're joined at the hip, really. And the ultimate aims are the same. It's the means by which we achieve them that have changed with the internet and social media. It's how we get informed. It's the dangers we face in trying to get informed of fake news and deep fakes and, you know, all of that, which I don't particularly enjoy wading into, but I recognize it's a very, very big problem and about to get much bigger with AI.
Yeah, you want to go there?
Not really. Not really.
Okay.
I will if you want.
No. That's okay. Too big of maybe another conversation we can have on that. But there's definitely, that's what is coming. But let's stay to what it is, mm-hmm. right?
So but you asked why education has been declining in America. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a broad cultural phenomenon that started with electronic media, started with radio and television, really, and people reading less and talking to each other less. That's a key part of it. You know, when we talk to each other on the internet or through social media, it's a different kind of face-to-face interaction. It's not genuinely face-to-face. And I think we suffer unconsciously from too much interaction on that level and not enough on the human level, where we really talk and really listen and something really comes out of it. So much, as you know, of social media is just us cowering under a wave of data and information and stimuli coming at us that don't really improve us. So
when I think about critical thinking, the word critical, right? It's not mm-hmm. that have a negative connotation. We think about, you know, a food critic or a restaurant or
not at all
a movie, but it's not. It's actually constructive usually.
And in fact, food and movie critics have a constructive role too. It includes exactly. being negative and it includes being positive. So critical thinking is really, is really rational thinking. There isn't much difference, right. if any. Right. It's rational thinking about not how to be a hunter-gatherer or achieve something specific in the world, but it's about ideas and it's about how we relate to each other, things like that. It's following rules and reasons, basically.
So I keep thinking of what you said in terms of online social media relationship. You know, we spent the past 3 years of the pandemic working from home, learning from home. We are recording right now on the platform that we are there. Mm-hmm. So, but you said that it has a different level of relationship of communication, interaction, let's say. Am I getting that right, that on your opinion, it's more superficial, the kind of relationship?
I think so.
Can you explain that better?
It's not something I've been studying necessarily, but my overall sense is that when we're in a room with people live, more learning takes place and more teaching takes place than when we're looking at a screen, except for this show.
Except for the people in the room right now.
Right.
Or in the virtual room. So are we too late? I mean, is that a way to, is really democracy, critical thinking, relationship?
We're not too late. We're not too late in the sense that we have no choice. We can't go back. We have to have a democracy under these conditions. That may mean regulating AI. And I think that's probably a very important thing to do. it may mean limiting certain ways in which we use TikTok or whatever, without the sort of political grandstanding that the governor of Montana has been doing, just to make him look anti-Chinese. It's serious, useful regulation without overregulation to keep things on there on the rails, and to keep our discourse from getting too crazy, and to protect us from the worst possible predations of electronic media, of AI, like fake politician voices, you know, to use against your opponent to make it sound like they're saying something which they're not, things like that. We have to somehow get that under control, or it's hopeless for democracy.
It's like the worst version of Orwell, 1984.
Yes.
When you can really alterate, you know, the news, yeah, and the past, the present, and, yeah, the future.
Well, I use the example of Orwell to describe the value of the liberal arts, because you do not read Orwell in a business school class or in a computer science class, which is not to say that we don't need STEM learning too. It's very important, but we need to supplement it with the liberal arts and with books like 1984, which show us what evils human nature is capable of and what we should be trying to make happen and prevent from happening.
Hmm. This brings me to this. Your view, and I am quite critic about the education system. I think it's a little obsolete in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost like technology is about practicality and STEM, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
But that's probably what have been happening and in the educational system. And I believe that's true in almost every country in the world, as far as I, yeah, know, and I'm not an expert. But I can
we're also not getting good enough teachers, because we're not, as a society, willing to pay them what they're worth.
And I would love to go there, because my last comment before I give it back to you is that with the job that I do, I talk to a lot of people that are futurists, technologists, but I talk to a lot of philosophers, because there's never been, in my opinion, at least since when I'm alive, such a strong relationship between technology, understanding who we are, and the fact that we talk about ethics way more than we've ever talked, I think, in the common conversation or the news, like we're doing now. I mean, ethics for AI is almost like a way to learn ourselves, learn about, yeah, who we are. So, but at the same time, as you said, we're not paying enough the teacher to promote this liberal thinking, whatever that means. So,
well,
how can we fix that?
Let's say small d democratic thinking. I'll give you one, mm-hmm, example. We got to teach more civics in high school, quite apart from the value the liberal arts may lend to an education for citizenship. Every American has to learn how their government works. That should not even be debatable. And that means there should be a civics section on the SAT test and the ACT test and so on, so that schools are forced to teach it. That's one way to start. It's such a big systemic problem, Marco. You can't only address it from one entry point, but that's one, I would say. And another is to encourage STEM students to take more liberal arts courses. And then there's a whole big societal problem of how we got to the point where we're divided, not so much on left-right political lines, but on educated versus less educated lines. And the right has convinced its base that their enemy, their the elites that are oppressing them, are the educated people in this country, as opposed to the truly powerful people like corporations and major organizations. They've conned their followers into believing that, and it's really tragic, because as soon as you start demonizing education, democracy's in trouble.
True to that. I mean, if you keep people, I don't want to go back to, you mentioned the Roman Empire a few times, but it makes me think about Panem and Circenses, where you give them bread and circus, mm-hmm. and they're not going to put their mouth into the politics of the city. Now, that's an extreme. I don't even know how ultimately true that is, but let's assume it is. It's kind of what we're facing nowadays, no? Entertainment, commercial capitalism, yes. and
exactly.
I don't care who's out there making the rules or what the rules
are.
And
this isn't new. Neil Postman wrote about this in the 1980s and 90s. He wrote a great book called Amusing Ourselves to Death, and another of other prescient books that I think preceded the internet, but identified all of these problems that interfere with learning and interfere with cohesion, citizenship, communities. You know, language, using language is a form of community. Rationality is a form of community. It's agreeing. It's a kind of language for thinking that enables us to agree about certain things. I say I'm doing this because of that. I say I'm acting this way because of that rule or that idea or that guideline. It's a way of coming together. It's not a way of separating us, as our values sometimes do separate us and have to separate us, but it's a common ground. We're losing some of that in the era of electronic communication. And Postman was one of the first. Gerrymander was another, when he wrote Four Arguments Against Television, Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. Not a serious title, but a very serious book. And so I'm not the first to be on that bandwagon.
No, I can see a lot of the, and share a lot of your thoughts. Maybe I'm more positive in my thinking with technology because it's my my job and looking ahead, but also because I need to stay a little positive about things when I balance dystopia and utopia. But you know it's there, you know it's a possibility.
And I'm certainly not an anti-tech person.
No, I understand that, but you're raising
technology. May end up saving us from the predations of technology, actually. When it comes to, for example, global warming, I don't think we have the political will to make the sacrifices it will require, but I think the technology may get us out of it, if we're lucky. Yeah. But I always go back to something Henry David Thoreau said in the 19th century. He said, our machines are but, perfect means to imperfect ends.
Yes.
So we still have to argue about our ends and which ends we're going to pursue. He said improved means to an unimproved ends, if I may correct that. We still have to improve our ends, and that's what democratic conversations are about. But technology will always improve our means, whether we like it or not. And every invention we can possibly achieve is going to be used in some way for good or for ill.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's tool in the end. That's the point. Listen, as we wrap this conversation, which I could have with you sitting with a coffee probably for hours, because I have a lot of thinking of the things you're discussing. I would like to wrap it up with two things. One, and you mentioned at the beginning, who's this book for? Because I think as a writer, you always have your audience there. And you kind of mentioned, yes, but I'd like you to go a little bit more in that. Because sure. I know that part of it is students and the new generation, the upcoming, the next future generation. Some advices maybe on how to think more critically or why they should embrace liberal arts. So kind of like a manifesto. Yeah.
Well, if you can't sell citizenship and democratic citizenship, you shouldn't be trying to sell anything because it's hopeless. I wrote the book to resolve the questions in my mind and to provide a template for people who are looking either going into the liberal arts or involved in the liberal arts as students or graduate students or as educators, deans, anybody making decisions about higher education, and try to figure out these questions of critical thinking and citizenship and what the liberal arts are. I think I succeed, frankly, in inside the liberal arts, at least on my own terms. And I certainly welcome any arguments or feedback from your viewers, listeners, readers. But that's the general idea. It's to give people sort of a handbook on critical thinking that's also a model of what the liberal arts are all about and why.
Well, that sounds, again, you say it took you 2 years, probably on top of those two years, even
more than two,
your entire life thinking about it.
Yes.
It's kind of like,
and I want to make a quick plug for one of my favorite authors, whom you will know, Norberto Bobbio, is one of my heroes, one of my great heroes as an Italian writer on politics and political theorist.
Very good. Very good. Thank you for doing that for the country. I think it's an important book. I've read the summary and few excerpts, but it's definitely something that I am interested in. And I think it should be honestly read by anyone. So again, this is Inside the Liberal Arts, Critical Thinking and Citizenship. We will have links to connect with you, whatever you want to share for people to connect with you, to your website, to where the book can be found. And again, great, as you said, and I said at the beginning too, my goal, and it sounds also your goal, is to make people think. So if you want to think a little bit, if you want to read, have an open mind, forget
here's
the politics. Here's your chance. Very well said. Very well said, Jeff. I want to thank you again for people watching the video. Glad you stick around. For people maybe driving in the car, walking the dogs, and just listen to the audiobook, I hope you got something out of it. And feel free to comment, share, subscribe, get the word going. We need to think, everybody, a little bit more. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco. Great to be with you.
Devo unlocks the full value of machine data for the world's most instrumented enterprises. The Devo Data Analytics Platform addresses the explosion in volume of machine data and the crushing demands of algorithms and automation. Learn more at devo.com. BugCrowd's award-winning platform combines actionable contextual intelligence with the skill and experience of the world's most elite hackers to help leading organizations identify and fix vulnerabilities, protect customers, and make the digitally connected world a safer place. Learn more at bugcrowd.com. Black Cloak provides concierge cybersecurity protection to corporate executives and high net worth individuals to protect against hacking, reputational loss, financial loss, and the impacts of a corporate data breach. Learn more at blackcloak.io.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.